Good morning, Folsom. Good morning to our visitors. I love that song. I love to hear us sing it. Thank you, Dave, for your songs this morning. I appreciate you working with me. I didn't decide that I wanted to make some song selections until Thursday this week, so I appreciate Dave being so accommodating in that regard. I was slightly surprised and certainly a bit intimidated when David Posey came to me and asked to fill in for him this week and continue with his third installment of his First John lesson series. But I'm going to try my best this morning not to disappoint him. So what is this series that we've been talking about, that David's preached two weeks prior? It comes from 1 John. You can certainly go ahead and start turning there if you'd like. The first week he talked about the fact that we can have confidence in Christ. And we can do that because we know who Christ is and what he did for us, and that he will not disappoint us. Last week, he was in John chapter 2, 1 John chapter 2, and he asked, "Do you know the Lord?" He wanted to make sure that we understood what it takes to know the Lord. These are things that, these are both questions and things that the book of 1 John, when John was writing it, he brought up, that he, questions that he raised. Which brings us to my lesson today. And go ahead and look at John chapter 2, verses 7 through 11 this morning. I'll be reading out the English Standard Version. I want to talk about something old and something new. Now, I believe the original phrase is something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. And I don't have anything blue or anything borrowed for you this morning. I'm also not getting married, so there's that point as well. But we are going to talk about something old and something new. This is a picture of my brother. I think this picture represents a pretty stark contrast between the two of us. I take after my mother's side more. I have more of the doer genes in me. My brother tends to take after the McGinnis side of my family, my dad's side of the family more. He's got the red hair and the red beard with the freckles, and he can't stay out in the sun for more than 10 minutes or else he starts to roast. We're also very different in personality, though. We're completely different. If you got to know us at all, you would not think that we were brothers. He's very bookish and logical, and he was valedictorian of his class. He was a band geek. I was the two-sport athlete, and not very bookish, and not philosophical in most ways. So there's a lot of differences between the two of us. But that doesn't mean I don't love him. That doesn't mean I don't care about him. That doesn't mean that if he called me up today and said, "I need you to come down to UC Irvine and see me," I wouldn't get up and do that at a moment's notice. I like to think that he feels the same way about me. I can't be 100% sure, though. I offer you this story. While we were growing up, me and my brother, my younger brother, and my two younger sisters would get together and play outside on many days. Now, for the younger people in the audience, playing outside is something that happened before the internet came into existence. It involved zero screens. There were no memes involved. It was just whatever you could find to do outside with your hands. Physical activity. And so we decided that, or I decided rather, I was usually in charge of these things, being the oldest, decided that we were going to play tag, but up the ante a little bit. Now, we usually played games in our side yard that had several bushes and trees scattered throughout. So I thought, to make things more interesting, I would make the rule that the person that was it had to have their eyes closed. The only other stipulation being that the others that were not it, that were being chased or pursued after, could only walk, and that they had to make some sort of noise. So since it was my rule, I decided I was going to be it first. I closed my eyes and counted to 10, and then took off walking after my siblings, with my eyes closed still. Well, my brother decided to stand behind a small white oak in our yard and started making noises to attract me. As I drew closer to him, I quickened my pace until I broke out into full run. I think you probably realize what happened next. The next thing I know, I was laying on the ground with bits of bark embedded in my face. Lots of blood coming out of my nose. I don't remember that very well. It's pretty foggy. I'm sure I sustained some sort of concussion or something like that, of that nature. But I didn't go to the doctor for it. I just got dragged back inside, and we took care of it then and there. As I said, I think my brother loves me. I think he cares about me. Before we get to our text this morning, I want to provide you guys a little bit of background information. I think David's done that with his previous messages, but it never hurts to revisit these things. The disciple whom Jesus loved is John. His brother was James. His father was Zebedee. They were known as the Sons of Thunder. Peter and James and John were Jesus' inner circle. They were those that were closest to him of the apostles. He did write 5 books. I believe he wrote the Gospel of John first, then wrote towards the end of his life the 3 epistles, 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John, and then finished his life with Revelation once he was stranded on the Isle of Patmos. He was the last remaining apostle. I believe the only one not to be martyred for his beliefs. And as I said, 1 John was probably written somewhere between 90 and 95 AD with the 3 other books to follow. He wrote it in response to a movement that was starting to gain traction. Gnosticism didn't come into full effect until the 2nd century. You didn't really see it strongly develop until the 200s, but John was, even in 90 AD, 95 AD, John was still writing against it. Some of the tenets of Gnosticism are this esoteric knowledge, this specialized knowledge, a secret knowledge. Something that's esoteric is very specialized. It would be like a group of biologists getting together and discussing the migratory patterns of swallows throughout the months of June through August. Something very specialized. Only a very few people that would have privy to that knowledge and would be able to understand it. They taught that this was the path to salvation, this esoteric knowledge. They also taught that God was not the only God, that he created this demiurge as well. And this demiurge was the God that created the world. And brought humans into existence, that this demiurge is the God of the Old Testament. Well, we know that's not the case. They also taught that we needed to reject the world because of its evil ways, and because it was created imperfectly by this demiurge, and that we also need to reject our human bodies because they were made by this being as well. That these were imperfect and subject to evil, and therefore we needed to fully reject them and only accept the spiritual. Which is why John developed these 3 tests. A social test, a moral test, and a doctrinal test. He keeps coming back to these 3 topics, these 3 subjects within this letter, because he's trying to counteract the message of the Gnostics. He wants us to ask ourselves, do I love the brethren? Do I keep the commandments? And do I believe that Jesus is the Christ? Do I believe that Jesus is who he says he is? The ingenious part of John, the part that I find brilliant about his writing, is that he writes in a cyclical manner. He keeps bringing these points up over and over again. In fact, in this letter, he mentions the topic, the thing we're going to talk about this morning, 3 separate times. In our text for this morning, 1 John chapter 2, verses 7 through 11, he talks about loving the brethren. Do I love the brethren? He brings it up again in John chapter 3, verse 11 through 24, and makes the point that Cain murdered his brother Abel and hated his brother. He says that even if we hate our brothers, then we are just as guilty of murder as Cain was. And it's echoing the thoughts that Jesus gave early on in his ministry. 1 John chapter 4, verses 7 through 21, he talks about God being love. God himself is love. And in order for us to be able to abide with God or abide in God, we have to love our brethren. If we don't do that, then we cannot exist with God. We cannot coexist with him in a fellowship manner. That's enough background for this morning, so let's jump into our text. I'll be reading the first two verses only, verses 7 and 8. 1 John chapter 2, verses 7 through 8. Beloved, I am writing you no new commandment, but an old commandment that you had from the beginning. The old commandment is the word that you have heard. At the same time, it is a new commandment that I am writing to you, which is true in him and in you, because the darkness is passing away and the true light is already shining. Just within these two verses, there's a lot for us to look at here. He starts out and saying, Beloved, I am writing you no new commandment, but an old commandment, something that has been there from the very beginning. You say, I don't remember anything about loving the brethren in the Old Testament. That's something that seems like a very New Testament idea, but it's not. If we turn to Leviticus chapter 19, verses 17 through 18, you see when it reads, You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself, I am the Lord. Now he says, okay, so this has been here from the beginning. This is something that was instituted by God to the people of Israel from the very get-go. But he also says, he goes on to say, that this is a new commandment. Well, if it's been there since the very beginning, how can it be a new commandment? We turn to John chapter 13, verses 34 through 35, the Gospel of John. And we read there that Jesus is speaking to his disciples. He's just finished with the Lord's Supper. He's just finished instituting this. He just finished washing their feet. And now he's preparing them for the eventuality of his death. And he says this to them, A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, just as I have loved you. You also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. And that's the new commandment. That's the key right there. Just as I have loved you. He says it's not enough just to love your brethren. He says you have to love as I loved you. What did Jesus do for them? Think of the numerous times that he spent teaching them, that he spent helping them to understand these things that they just wouldn't understand. The fact that he went to the cross for them is the obvious one. The sacrifice that he made. He said, you can't just say, I love my brother. You can't just do small things for him. Do something big for your brother. Make sacrifices for your brother. See my example and learn from it. I find it interesting in verse 8, at the very end of verse 8, when he says, The darkness is passing away and the true light is already shining. It took me a minute to understand what he was talking about here. But Isaiah chapter 9 verse 2 helps me to understand. It reads, The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in the land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. The true light is already shining. The darkness here is lack of knowledge. It's lack of understanding. There was a dark period of about 400 years between the Old Testament and the New Testament. A separation of God of sorts. Jesus was the shining light that came and brought light to that darkness that took the darkness away. We see that in John, the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verses 9 through 10, when it says, The true light which gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. Jesus is that true light that is shining in our lives, that we need to cling to. Let's go ahead and look at the next couple of verses. Verses 9 through 11. Whoever says he is in the light and hates his brother is still in darkness. Whoever loves his brother abides in the light, and in him there is no cause for stumbling. But whoever hates his brother is in the darkness and walks in the darkness and does not know where he is going, because the darkness has blinded his eyes. John attacks this from every angle. He wants to leave no doubt with his readers what he's talking about here. He says, whoever says he is in the light, you can say all you want to that you're walking in the light, that you have the love of the brethren in your heart, but your actions are what's going to prove you right or wrong, whether you are or not. Number two, he says, whoever loves his brother. If the love of your brother abides in you, then you abide in the light. If you are dwelling or living with your brother in harmony, then you are in harmony with the light. You are in line with the message of Christ. You are not being a stumbling block to others. You're not tearing other people down or bringing other people down with you. He says, whoever hates his brother, if you hate your brother, you're walking in darkness. You're walking away from God. You're walking away from Christ. You're rejecting the message. And then he explains what walking in darkness means. He says, you are as one that is lost. You're one that's stumbling around. You're one that's disoriented, that doesn't understand his unsaved condition. He doesn't know where the light is to be found anymore. He's become accustomed to the dark. It's what he knows. It's what he understands. As Christians, we must evade this condition. We cannot become accustomed to walking in the dark. We cannot reject our brothers and sisters in Christ. So this is a lot of good information here. A lot of things that are easy to understand. And John does an excellent job of presenting that here. But we need to, before we can apply it to our own lives, we need to know who exactly is our brother. Well, I like this picture. I like this message here. But our neighbor is not our brother. I agree with everything on this page, and Jesus said that we are to love our neighbors as ourselves, and identifies in the Good Samaritan just exactly who our neighbor is. It's someone that's in need, or someone that has a need from us. We can go down this list and think of a way to love each and every person on it. But that's not what we're talking about here this morning. We're not talking about neighbors. Paul writes in Galatians chapter 6, verses 9 and 10, and let us not grow weary of doing good, for in due season we will reap, if we do not give up. So then, as we have opportunity, let us do good to everyone, especially to those who are of the household of faith. Like I said, we need to appreciate and love everyone that's on this list, every type of person that we come in contact with in this world. But we need to give special care, special attention to those that are in our own family. It makes sense, right? Your immediate family are the people that you spend the most time with. The people that you care the most for, generally. And it should be that way with Christians as well, if we apply that statement to the world. The people who are of like faith, who share our faith and beliefs, we should be most loving towards them. We should give them preference over others who are our secular neighbors. Now that we've established who our brother is, and brothers and sisters in Christ, we have to ask ourselves, how can we go about loving the way Christ loves us? How do we make this happen? How do we apply this to our lives? I have some theories. Surprise attacks. What does this have to do with loving your brother? Well, just bear with me for a moment. I typed in surprise attacks, and this is what came up on the internet, and I was surprised by it, so it was effective. No one ever expects a shark jumping out of the kiddie pool. They never see it coming. But there are some things about the nature of surprise attacks themselves that we can apply to being loving towards one another. Number one, we need to be proactive. We need to be aggressive. We need to be looking for opportunities to help one another. We need to catch people off guard. We need to make them understand just how much we love them and do things that they're not expecting us to do. Go above and beyond. You know, a lot is made sometimes, I think, of small gestures of kindness. Small little things such as, maybe a cup of lemonade on a hot day or just something of that nature. Opening a door for someone, maybe. And that's well and good. That's a good place to start. With showing kindness to one another and showing love for one another. But it has to evolve from there. It has to become bigger. It has to become more over time. You know, at some point, we need to get better at doing this, at showing kind gestures to one another. We need to be able to make people that feel, especially in a time in our lives or at a time on this earth when our beliefs are being attacked just as much as they ever have been, we need to make people feel safe and cared for and loved. Next, we need to exhibit puppy love. We need to show the kind of love for one another that dogs show towards us. You know, everyone says a dog is a man's best friend. Maybe they should be the ones that are training us when it comes to teaching people how to love one another. I overheard two guys talking one time. The first guy said, "My wife is my best friend. She loves me so much and I love her." The second guy replied, "Well, that's nice, but do you have a dog?" The first guy said, "Yeah, I've got a German Shepherd. What's it to you?" The second guy said, "Your dog loves you more than your wife does." The first guy responded, he said, "You're wrong. No, my wife loves me more than my German Shepherd does. She loves me unconditionally. She's been with me through thick and thin. She helped raise our children together. She loves me more than my dog." Second guy said, "No, you're wrong." Said, "Here, I can prove it to you. Take your wife and your dog and lock them in the back of your trunk. Come back in 2 hours and see which one's happy to see you." So, your dog loves you more than your wife. What is it about the love of a dog that captures our attention, that makes us so happy to see them? I think it's because dogs are uncomplicated. They're pretty simple when it comes to their love. They're really willing to go forward and chase whatever danger that they think, or bark at, or, you know, run down whatever car or squirrel, whatever they think is going to possibly harm us. They want to protect us. They're loyal to a fault. You know, they're never gonna keep score. They're never gonna say, "Well, you know, I saved you from 14 cars and 13 squirrels and one rattlesnake today, so you kind of owe me big for that one." They're not gonna do that. Even if you step on a dog's paw or inadvertently or accidentally bump into a dog or cause them pain in some sort of way, it's usually that frustration or them being upset usually dissipates within a matter of seconds. And they forget about it so quickly. They're so willing to forgive. They're willing to make real life sacrifices for us. They're willing to put their life on the line for us if they think that's going to do something to protect us. This is a very difficult concept, I think, for us to grapple with as humans and think about. What's our first reaction whenever someone does something wrong to us? Whenever someone, gets in our way on purpose, and you know for a fact that they're doing it just to spite you, our reaction is to dislike that person, to hate them. I've seen this even within the community of Christ, even within the church. You know, people doing these things, and we can't be like that. We all know Jesus said if someone asks you for the shirt off your back, you give it to them, and then you give them your coat as well. You don't ask questions. You know, you don't become frustrated whenever someone wrongs you. You're dogmatic in your forgiveness. These are the traits that we need to adopt. as Christians when we're trying to love each other. Lastly, handle your business. Everyone knows that this is Jack Horak's motto. I think this picture was taken at the 2017 NorCal camp. I'm not sure what he's doing there, making biscuits or something. But, you know, working at the camp in the kitchen area the last couple of years has been really, it's difficult work. It's hard work and long days, long hours, you're on your feet all the time. But I love working with Jack. And I would go to war for Jack because I know Jack would go to war for me. There's some things about handling our business, though, that will help put us in a position to succeed in our love for one another. Number one is take care of your priorities. Handle your family affairs. You need to make sure that you're in a position in life to where you can, that when a need arises, when a brother or sister in Christ comes to you and says, I need you to do something for me, I need this, something went terribly wrong, I need your help, be sure that you're in a position to help that person. Whatever that means for you. Maybe you're the breadwinner. Maybe you're just a homework doer. Maybe you're a snack maker. Maybe you're a rule enforcer within your own family. But make sure that stuff gets taken care of. Help your family get to a place where you can, as a unit, focus on doing things for other people within the church. Look for opportunities. Make sure you're making the most of the opportunities when they're presented. You know, don't stand idly by and just wait for something to fall into your lap. It goes back to being proactive and looking for ways that you can get involved and help. And then be consistent about it. This isn't just a one-off thing and something you check off your list and say, well, I've done my good deed for today or this week or this month or this year or whatever it is, however you justify it in your mind. This is something you do consistently every time there's a need, every time something arises. Jesus certainly wants us to make sure our business is handled. So how do we put all these thoughts and concepts into action? What's the real life application for this? It's the current map of the wildfire situation in Northern California. From what I understand, it's one of the worst, if not the worst, year in history for wildfires in this area. I'm sure there are lots of brothers and sisters in Christ that could use our support, that could use some help. On a personal, individual basis, I'm not advocating for the church to go out seeking for this, but this is something you can do on your own. This is something you can do to make a real impact in someone else's life. Get involved in a relief effort. Or if you don't feel comfortable doing that, look at the view. Or listen to the, make sure and pay special attention to the announcements in the morning. There are lots of people that need a kind word, that need something small, a card or flowers or something of that nature. Something small we can do today. And make sure we're doing those things. Make sure we're staying current with the needs of the congregation. Now this is something Anne Frank wrote in her diary. No one has ever become poor by giving. The rewards for extending a helping hand are numerous and remarkable. Even if there's not some tangible result there, it's something that you can see immediately that reflects on you or is paid back to you in some way. There are intangible results. There are rewards that you don't necessarily realize all at once. There's always some benefit to showing Christian love to one another, to someone in need. You know, after I ran into that tree and was laying on the ground and wondering what was going on, my brother helped pick me up, and he brushed me off. And he helped me get back inside the house, and he put some frozen peas on my face, and brought me a pillow and fixed me a sandwich. And even though my brother and I are extremely different in many ways, you know, there's still a lot of love between us. He loves me, and I love him, and that's never going to change. So I guess really the only question left to ask is, Are you my brother? Am I speaking to a room full of brothers and sisters this morning? Or am I just speaking to a room of people that happen to know who I am? Are others able to recognize the unconditional love within us? According to 1 John chapter 2, in order for brotherhood to exist between us, there has to be mutual love. There has to be a relationship, fellowship. If the love is only on one side, then one of us has to be walking in darkness. One of us has alienated themselves from God. I don't want that to be you. If you've not accepted the perfect love of Christ, if you have not put him on in baptism this morning, we offer that opportunity to you right now. If you are guilty of neglecting a brother, or hating someone that's part of this family, part of this community, we offer you the opportunity to fix that. I'd like to invite you to come forward now as together we stand and sing.